This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I'm your host, Jeff.
And I'm your other host, Kim.
Welcome to episode 29, where we review Diary of a Madman from 1963. Look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century. That's 20th. We post our next movie selection there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. So tonight is a little bit of a date night for you and I.
Yep.
We saw our son off to
protocol.
It's called protocol. Explain protocol.
It's like prom for homeschoolers. Well, prom for our particular brand of homeschoolers. Since we use this particular classical education model, it's our kids get together, the high schoolers. They do like a cultural event, maybe a symphony. They go see a musical or a play or something. Mostly our kids have seen a symphony the past couple times they've done this. So they go to a really nice restaurant where they actually get like four courses and they have to use the right forks and the right knives and the right glasses. So tonight, I believe they're going to see the Florida Orchestra perform Broadway hits.
Yeah,
so
that's what Jefferson said. Yeah, the hits of Broadway.
Yes.
So we dropped him off, and then you and I went to one of our favorite restaurants, the Chop Shop in Lakeland, Florida.
Yeah, we've mentioned the Chop Shop before. I think maybe last season.
Yeah.
We've mentioned the Chop Shop several times.
Yeah. This place, one thing we love about it, right, they're decorated with all this really eclectic decor.
Yeah.
Right? And it's very much, they have rockabilly music playing, they have a big screen TV playing usually some old cheesy B movie.
Yes.
Sci-fi, exactly. Horror. Right up our alley, right?
Yes. That's a test for the B movies we watch, right? Like, could this play at Chop Shop while you're eating and like just be part of the ambiance?
Yeah. And actually, in our conversation tonight, we talked about something that, you know, what we've been watching lately. Mystery Science Theater, they have a new season that they started.
That's right.
Through their Kickstarter campaign. They've done two episodes so far. And the first one has a character called El Santo, and I forget the name of the movie, but basically he's fighting Dracula. So think of a Mexican luchador. El Santo, of course, means the saint.
And he's wearing his luchador mask, right?
Yeah, he wears his mask. Even when he's in a really nice suit and everything, he wears his luchador mask. And this guy, apparently, El Santo, in real life, was a celebrity in Mexico. I've read up a little bit about him and heard about him. You know, he's not like equivalent to like Steve Austin or The Rock or anything. He's like a cultural phenomenon, or was for years. Like to the tune of 40 or 50 years.
Wow. In Mexico. Okay. That's a big deal.
And so he acted in movies, but he also wrestled. And actually in the movie that they aired, there is like a full wrestling match in the movie itself. Basically the future of the world, the freedom of the world is dependent on this wrestling match. So I started looking on Tubi TV. There's all sorts of El Santo movies and, you know, him against werewolves. And it's just kind of this crazy genre, right? Where you have a wrestler against some sort of mystical being, you know, or supernatural presence.
Yeah, seems like a mismatch, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, how are these two things together? But it works. You know, it's fun. Like, it's silly. I think it's just perfect fodder for Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It definitely works for MST3K.
Oh, yeah. So other than Mystery Science Theater, what else have we been watching lately?
Well, I wanted to go back. I think last episode we mentioned we are, of course, late to the game, but we've been watching Ted Lasso, and we felt like, you know, we were very early in on the second season, and we felt like it lost the edge of the first season. But we were wrong. There's still edge coming.
Yeah.
So I just want to clarify, like, we get it. You don't have to write in and tell us, like, we're way off.
Yeah.
Now Ted Lasso's dealing with his panic attacks, like, that are kind of coming out of the blue. And his therapist has been, you know, hit by a car on her bike.
Yeah.
And not just his therapist. She's, like, the whole team's therapist. And she's really, like, made some major strides with some of the teammates. And Ted needs her services, obviously, the most.
Yeah.
Which is where the edginess is mostly coming from.
Right.
Then we had the whole dad thing with Jamie Tartt and his dad just being so horrible and abusive.
Yeah. And a lot of dad issues in this one.
There's a lot of dad issues in Ted Lasso.
Lasso talks about his dad. We won't spoil that, but there's like a major downer with his dad, right?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. So we were just like one episode away from realizing like, oh, it actually hasn't lost its edge.
Yeah. There was an episode that centered around Coach Beard which there was a moment when I thought Coach Beard is done for.
Yeah, we really thought, like, legit, oh my gosh, like, we're about to like see the demise of Coach Beard.
Yeah.
Thankfully, well, yeah. I mean, I should say I won't spoil it, but everybody else is probably ahead of us on this.
Right.
So. Coach Beard is still with us as of right now, but we also are still behind on watching it. So
we have three episodes left.
Okay, three episodes in the season. Mm-hmm. Do we know? Is there a season three? Is Ted Lasso continuing? Because I'm
sure
pretty
it is.
Invested right now.
I'm very invested too. I'm pretty sure it is. It's, you know, it's successful, right?
Right.
And what else does Apple have going? I mean, I know they have the
Coda. Bumped into our sweet little godson who's about to be 6 years old, and he was wearing a Believe t-shirt the other day with the little classic Ted Lasso. I say classic like it's been around for years, but the Ted Lasso yellow sign with Believe written in the middle was on his t-shirt.
Yeah.
So I think it's here to stay. I hope Ted Lasso is here to stay for a little while. Okay, this week we are watching Diary of a Madman from 1963. Spoiler alerts, we will be spoiling this for you. So if you don't like that, stop now, go watch it, and come back and listen to us later.
Hey, so last week we said it was on Amazon Prime.
Oh, that's right.
Almost as soon as we said it, Amazon took it down, and you have to pay for it on Amazon.
Yes.
So how we watched it this week is we did a trial period for Paramount Plus, and it is on Paramount Plus. So one other thing, he has another movie out there that we reviewed last year, Twice Told Tales.
That's right.
So if you want to watch both of them and listen to both podcasts, now's your chance. You can get a 7-day trial for free, Paramount Plus.
There you go. There's your plug for a free trial at Paramount Plus. Yes. So this is another Vincent Price movie. It is rated PG. I think that probably was awarded to it later than when it was actually made and put out there, because I think this came out before we had like legit ratings for movies. However, I will say it's family friendly. We've watched this with most of our kids in the room.
Yeah.
It's all good. So what in the world is it about? So we have Simon Cordier. That would be our Vincent Price character. He's a well-respected French magistrate who visits a condemned prisoner, Louis Giraud, just before the man's execution. Giraud again pleads his innocence, insisting that he has been taken over by a spirit that forced him to commit his crimes. Cordier obviously does not believe him, and the man freaks out. They get into a little bit of a fisticuff situation, and he hits his head and dies, right?
Yep.
So Cordier does, however, note that there was a rapid change in the man's personality during their short interview. In the following days, Cordier must face a number of strange occurrences in his home. He begins to wonder, is he sleepwalking? Is he hearing voices? Maybe he's losing his own sanity. It's recommended to him that he should take up sculpting, which is a hobby he used to enjoy. So he develops a relationship with an artist model named Odette, who happens to be a gold digger married to a struggling artist. But the evil, invisible spirit soon drives Cordier to murder.
Ooh.
And that is mostly from scripts.com.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. So you and I first saw this when we watched Twice Told Tales. We were trying to figure out, what should we watch? Mm-hmm. We knew we wanted to do a Vincent Price movie. So exactly. We watched about three films in May of last year. So we said, hey, let's do Twice Told Tales, because we haven't done an anthology series yet.
Right.
But we knew we wanted to come back and do this. So now is that time. So we're excited to do this movie.
Yeah.
We had also watched The Pit and the Pendulum, Tales of Terror, House on Haunted Hill. So, we have a whole bunch of Vincent Price movies we can do.
Yeah, we
kind
of went through a mini catalog of Vincent Price movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot out there.
So, a few things about this movie. Basically, it was inspired by a short story, La Horla, otherwise known as The Horla, written in 1887, and how do you say this author's name?
I believe it's something, no, I do not speak French, so it's something along the lines of Guy de Maupassant.
Okay. Yeah, we'll get to this in a minute, but you actually went back and read this short story in preparation for this podcast.
Well, yes, I started to read it. I had a hard time staying awake. One was because I was reading a free PDF version off of my phone, and I need a, you know, pen and paper kind of book in my hand. Like, I like a real book. I don't do well reading off of, you know, digital media. So I was struggling to stay awake. So I actually went out to Audible and found an Audible version that I ended up listening to that I will say gets full recommendation for me. It was a fabulous narrator. In fact, I'll look him up here in a second and tell you who the narrator was, because I meant to have that pulled up and I forgot. But he was so dramatic in a good way. That really got me engaged in the story. And it is literally written like a diary. So it's like you're reading someone's diary. And he read it in such a way that you really felt like, you know, this is the guy's diary and this is his kind of slow dissension into insanity potentially. Yeah. So it was very well done. Let's see. His name was, Audible wants to start playing. I don't want you to start playing Audible. It was narrated by BJ Harrison. And I think in the, you know, the notes that they kind of read at the end of an Audible book, it sounds like BJ Harrison has a lot of recorded books out there. So I'd like to go hear more from him because he was an excellent narrator.
Okay. So you would definitely recommend the short story.
Highly recommend the short story.
Okay.
Yes.
And we'll come back to it in a bit because I'm interested in how it differs from the movie that we watched.
Yes.
So this movie was directed by Reginald Laborde, and he directed 68 films between 1936 and 1974.
Wow.
Mostly low-budget films. This was his second-to-last movie that he directed during his lifetime.
Oh, wow.
Best-known films are San Diego, I Love You, which features Buster Keaton in a supporting role from 1944, and of course, this film that we're reviewing today.
Okay.
I do have a poem for us today, too.
We're going to have poetry? Poetry with Jeff?
Poetry with Jeff.
All right.
So this is a case where we're going to, you know, if you get nothing else from this podcast, maybe you get a little bit of culture, right?
A little literary culture. Why are you reading us this poem?
I'm reading you this poem because it was referenced in the movie. So there was that critical part where Vincent Price meets Nancy Kovacs' character, Odette, and he's basically gets inspired and says he wants to sculpt the Laughing Lady.
Right.
And he references this poem that's called A Woman by Heinrich Heine.
You said that last name with some trepidation.
Heine. See, like,
is
that right?
It looks like Heine. I don't know.
Can you?
Heine.
Heinrich Heine.
I also don't speak German, so, you know.
We may be slaughtering that.
If you've got some Latin or some Arabic, I might can help you out a little bit, but I got nothing here.
So, but he describes the poem. It's four stanzas. So it takes up a good minute and a half of dialogue in the movie. And I thought, just like you went and you did the hard part, right? You went and read the short story. I was like, well, the least I could do is read this poem in preparation for this thing. So here we go. Four stanzas. It's not very long. They loved each other beyond belief. She was a strumpet. He was a thief. Whenever she thought of his tricks thereafter, she'd throw herself on the bed with laughter. The day was spent with reckless zest. At night she lay upon his breast. So when they took him, a moment after, she watched at the window with laughter. He sent word pleading, "Oh, come to me, I need you bitterly. Yes, here and in the hereafter." Her little head shook with laughter. At 6 in the morning, they swung him high. At 7, the turf on his grave was dry. At 8, however, she quaffed her red wine and sang with laughter.
Wow. So she sounds like so jovial in the beginning. And then it's like, wait, he's being hung and buried and you're still laughing.
Yeah.
Maybe she's a sociopath.
Well, you know, the more I think about it, I think this is a good representation of Nancy Kovacs' Odette character.
Yes, for sure.
Right? Because it's all fun and games in the first stanza. Mm-hmm. And then by the end, like, it's his demise.
Mm-hmm. But she's still moving on.
She's still laughing. Like, it's still to her pleasure.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a good point. Yeah. Because she clearly, she knows what she's about.
Yeah.
She's moving on. She's leaving her you know, struggling impoverished, artist. Struggling artist husband. And moving on to Vincent Price's magistrate character, who has money and a title and, you know, clearly is doing well for himself. And she didn't care about the poor struggling artist anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. She's ready. She's tired of living in poverty.
Yeah.
We're now going to transition to our section we call Standouts and Setbacks. The first standout I'll call out is the cinematography. It was by Ellis W. Carter. So much like Black Sabbath that you and I reviewed earlier this season, and the early Hammer horror films, I love the color and heavy contrast. So you have, and you know, heavy contrast situation, all the colors are bright and vibrant, and they just pop right off the screen.
Oh, yeah.
And all the darks are just super black. And it just look, it has a very specific look to it, right?
Right, yeah. It's very crisp almost.
Yeah. And a lot of his early movies, Vincent Price, maybe not his early movies, but yeah, this era had this look to him, right? So Twice Told Tales kind of had this look too, right?
Yeah, it's just rich. It's really rich. The colors are very rich looking.
It's very pleasing to the eye. So yeah, there you go. Cinematography. Another standout I'll mention is Nancy Kovac playing Odette. What a great performance. You and I have talked about this several times, but in the older movies, a lot of times the female characters kind of get shortchanged. They're not able to show a whole lot of depth of character.
Oh, for sure.
They're not able to show range. There's an exception here in this film. You know, I know, like, as I put myself in a movie, and I think a lot of men do this, they put themselves in the movie as whoever the character is.
Sure.
So when you're watching Nancy Kovac perform as Odette, from the eyes of Vincent Price, you kind of see this perfect woman because she's funny, she's charming,
she's beautiful,
she's gorgeous, yes. And, you know, she's pretty much like the perfect girl, like somebody that any man would want, right? But then when she's away from Vincent Price and she's dealing with her husband, you can kind of see her grumbling initially, like you're not making enough money for this family. I have to take these modeling gigs to help pay the bills. And you kind of see a little bit of emasculation of her husband.
Oh, for sure.
And then that, that digresses, right, into full-scale, like, mockery of her husband later on, right?
Right.
You also see, when her husband comes to confront Vincent Price, you see her appeal to Vincent Price, kind of like, please help me. You know, I really am a damsel in distress.
She uses the whole damsel in distress thing, even though she hasn't technically been a damsel in distress at all in the situation.
Not at all.
She is on the game. She's trying to,
And again, the way she puts it, again, I'm in there, her position, you know, Vincent Price's position. It's like, oh, I want to help this woman, you know, like, This poor fragile thing, like, I need to come to her defense, you know? There's lion that's come to my house. I need to protect her from this terrible lion. You see that side, and then you see later on when she confronts her husband, she's just mean and nasty. Basically, I am leaving you. I'm out of here. Right. You know, you've been horrible to me. And he says, well, this poor guy, I feel bad for him. You're going to, you know, spend his money. You're going to leave him, take his fortune. And she's like, yeah, I will, you know, and I'll move on to something better.
She owns up to it. Exactly.
And you just see the horns coming out of her head, you know, tail, all this metaphorically, right? But like pitchfork. And you just see this nastiness, awfulness that Vincent Price doesn't see. Like, he has no clue.
She is a legitimate gold digger.
Right. Now, the Horla sees it and knows her true character. And we'll get to the Horla in a second. But then you have this awful murder scene, which is probably the most grotesque part of the movie, right? The knife murder of Odette. But yeah, I mean, she's just on her A game in this movie. I've always been a Nancy Kovac fan. We talked a lot about her last year in Jason and the Argonauts.
Right.
And she looks great in that. But this movie, she gets to really flex her acting chops.
She was very one-dimensional in Jason and the Argonauts. And here she gets to be a full-fledged character, which is nice for her, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to calm the minds of anyone concerned, the grotesque scene you mentioned is not, like, we know that stabbing is happening, but you're not seeing the impact of that, right? Like, you see a bloody knife after. Yeah, and it's that whole, like, you see the bloody knife after, but it's like Crayola red. It's very clearly like, okay, that's not real.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about Vincent Price's performance. It's never going to be, I say never, maybe I haven't seen the Vincent Price movie yet where he is like a really outstanding actor. But in this case, he's not doing anything exceptional, but he's being Vincent Price, right? And so we discussed, I think when we talked about Omega Man with Charlton Heston,
right.
Like there's these older actors from a generation gone by, they had their, I don't want to say their niche, but they were who they were when they acted, and you knew what you were getting. You were getting Charlton Heston in whatever Charlton Heston acted in. I would say Vincent Price isn't quite on par with Charlton Heston as an actor, but you know what you're getting when you get Vincent Price, right?
Right.
Like he's always going to be Vincent Price.
Right. We talked about this. Yeah. Again, like you said, you know, John Wayne is always John Wayne in
exactly.
every movie.
Exactly. No matter what they're in, they're going to be who they are.
Right.
So, you know, Vincent Price shows that he's an upper-class magistrate. He's got almost a prissy vibe, like he's kind of hoity-toity, you know. But then there is a change in him when he starts stalking his victims, in this case, you know, really Odette.
Mm-hmm.
There's a clear transition. Like he is now the hunter, right? He is now like very menacing, almost pure evil. Like there's a switch in his eyes even.
Yeah.
You know, like the way he looks. And he's very good at that. Like he's good at turning off his kind of like, you know, upper class hoity-toity vibe to like, now I'm deadly and you should watch out, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Vincent Price is good at that. And that's what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it. He obviously takes out Odette. We know because we've just mentioned that. But there's another female character that doesn't get nearly as much screen time. But she's kind of on the side in love with Odette's husband, but is just a good friend to Odette's husband. And I think her and her dad seem to be like maybe a patron of Odette's artist husband.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he wants, Vincent Price also wants to go after her. And you see that switch in him then too. And he's like, mm-hmm. I'm going to trick her into coming here.
Right.
And I'm going to do away with her.
Yeah. And there's a functional reason for that, right?
Yeah. She's going to expose him for killing. Because what we haven't talked about, so if you see this movie, it's kind of a tricky, cool thing. Vincent mm-hmm. Price is into sculpting as like his like hobby of choice. Well, he ditches Odette's body somewhere and it gets discovered, but it's headless. Well, he has Odette's head in his sculpting gallery, covered in clay, like it's hidden as a sculpture.
Yeah,
and somehow Jean Darville, I'm not sure if I'm saying her first name correctly, but I think it's Jean, she's gonna expose him. Like she knows you have to be the last person that was seen with Odette. You have to be the guilty party, and she's gonna figure it out.
Right.
So he's like, oh no, she's got to go.
Yeah,
I gotta do away with her.
Right.
Yeah, and my other standout is really kind of this subtle, they're not on the nose about it. We don't get this right out in any of the movie, but there's some subtle history that we know the magistrate had a wife before we're seeing what's filmed here.
Uh-huh.
Had a wife and a son, and they're not with him anymore. And there's some sort of tragedy involved. We know that there's a painting of them that he doesn't like it being messed with in the house, and something like he likes it locked away, but it keeps showing back up. And we don't really know what's going on with that. But they never come out and tell us explicitly what happened to that wife and what happened to that son. And that really adds to the mystery of the movie.
Right.
Because there's never like a full explanation. But eventually the details reveal themselves that she apparently committed suicide at some point.
Yeah.
After the son's death. So I think he must have died a young death, maybe of some sort of childhood illness.
Uh-huh.
And she did not cope with that well, maybe. I mean, all of that's a little bit speculative, right?
Right.
I think she takes her own life, but there's definitely some guilt on Vincent Price's part.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some other people, maybe his staff that work at the house think he's a little bit guilty for the death of his wife, even if it was self-imposed.
We learn about it through the Horla. The Horla accuses him, basically, exposes, you know... Again, we'll talk about this in a second, about what is the Horla. But, you know, the Horla basically says, her death is blood on your hands.
Right, right. This is your fault. Like, this is on your head.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, that's never fully spelled out, and I kind of like that about the story. Like, it's just kind of in the background, and you're left... like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah.
How's he responsible for that?
Agreed. I think the whole community looks at the magistrate as a good and upstanding man.
Right.
So even this horrible guy, Louis, whatever his name is.
Giroux, I think, is the criminal. Yeah.
He asks to see the magistrate. Well, he's on death row. The trial is over.
Right.
Like, his, the magistrate.
Fate is sealed.
Yeah. The magistrate has no obligation there.
Right.
But out of the goodness of his heart, he's going to stop by and just hear what this guy has to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he shows this behavior over and over again,
right?
Where he does things that are like upstanding in the eyes of the citizens of the community.
Right.
But the Horla show, you know, basically throws out like, you're a slimy piece of crap, basically. You caused your wife to kill herself.
You're not as innocent as everybody thinks you are.
Yeah.
I think it's what the Horla starts putting in his mind.
Right.
Now, whether that's fully true, or if that's just the Horla working against him, I don't think we're ever fully aware of either.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think of the whole Bible verse, right? You know, be sure your sins will find you.
Right.
I think that applies.
Whatever's done in the dark will be exposed in the light of day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That does kind of apply here. And I guess the Horla is the tool that makes that come about. Really.
Right. And that's a great dovetail into my last stand out that I want to call out. But this whole idea, the concept of this cold-blooded killer, you know, we see people in the news that do horrible, awful things.
Right.
And, you know, it's easy to just say, like, they're crazy. Like, what's their deal? Like, I could never be them. You know, they're this otherworldly thing that exists.
Right.
Pure evil.
I mean, I think Hitler's like the prime example. Like, yeah. we can get into people in the news today, but Hitler's the easy.
Right.
To point your finger
you
at
have
and say,
Hitler,
like, pure evil, pure evil.
Yeah, you have Hitler, you know, you got Ted Bundy, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer, these just,
sure.
just crazy freaks that you're like, that could never be me. You know, that person is like way out there.
Right.
They do unspeakable things. Are they mentally ill? Are they disturbed beyond, you know, repair?
Right. Are they demon possessed?
Like, is it a chemical imbalance? Is it a biological component? Is there a supernatural element?
Mm-hmm.
It's called Diary of a Madman. Madman implies that this is all in his head.
Right. He's unstable.
He's unstable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is it a chemical imbalance, like this awful, ghastly murder that is happening, and there's just this stalking of this other young lady.
Sure.
Like, is this coming from something that is a trigger that happened?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he shakes Louis, whatever his name is, throws him down, kills him, and then, like, does that unleash this something that makes him start go on a killing spree.
Right.
Or is it kind of like the movie depicts, that it is like a supernatural transference?
Like a possession.
This possession thing, this evil thing transferred from Louis to the magistrate.
Right. We don't know.
And there's that whole adage of the devil made me do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, it wasn't me. It was the devil that made me kill this guy.
Well, that was clearly what the prisoner, Louis Giroux, at the beginning of the movie was trying to say. That's why he wanted an audience with Vincent Price's character, was to say, I'm trying to tell you guys, like, I didn't do this.
Yeah.
There's something came into me and made me do these things.
Yeah.
That was clearly his point of argument, which obviously didn't work for him because he was on death row.
So really, my standout here that I want to throw is, like, it's not spelled out to you. Like, is this guy just crazy? You know, and they kind of dismiss him at the end, right? Like, when they're, like, gathering, they're reading his
diary.
His diary. They're like, oh, this poor guy was just crazy.
Right. He's demented.
Because it's an easier path to take than, like, there's this supernatural being that's possessed this guy. And
Well, what do you do with that? Like, if somebody's just crazy and they've caused their own demise, then you can wash your hands of it and walk away.
Right.
But if it was like this demon possession and you don't know, like, has it gone somewhere else? Is it still among us? Did it die with him?
Yeah.
Like, waters get really murky there. Like, what do we do with this, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And what do we do with
this guy? It's cleaner to dismiss it as like, he was insane. He's gone now. Problem solved.
Yeah. Case closed. Right?
Right.
So, I do appreciate that in the movie, like, it is up to interpretation. Like, the title of the film goes completely in one direction.
Sure.
But then you actually see the Horla, you know, like in the fire, you see the interactions with the Horla.
Right.
So like what you see is kind of like, well, him interacting with this supernatural being or invisible being, right?
Right.
But then it's open, like, well, that could all just be in his mind.
Exactly. Is that in his mind or is that really happening? You don't know. The movie never takes a stance on that. And that is a cool trick of the movie.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, getting to setbacks, and I don't want to contradict myself about, like, not, I'm glad they didn't spell it out to me, but I was disappointed in the fire killing the Horla.
Right.
Like, if it is a supernatural being, a common fire wouldn't kill it.
Or would it? We don't know.
Well, we saw like the spirit transfer from Louis to the magistrate.
Right, right.
So if he's like this super spiritual being that can hop from one guy to the other, then it's not like he's the invisible man.
True. Maybe we don't know the rules here, though. Like, when he transferred from Louis Giraud to Vincent Price's character, the magistrate, like, Vincent Price was there.
Yeah.
But now they're in a room together, and they're ultimately both going to die in this fire.
Yeah.
So there, maybe there's nowhere for this invisible being to transfer to.
Yeah.
Maybe there has to be another human. Because they're alone. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just saying... No one's given us the rules.
I guess I think of the spiritual plane in which I don't have a physical body.
Right. So can it die in fire?
Maybe. How can a fire kill it? Or is it physical? Like the Invisible Man, it was a physical guy, which also Vincent Price played in the second Invisible Man.
Right? Yes.
He was the second Invisible Man. But like if it's just like this guy that can kind of walk around and do whatever he wants to do.
Yeah.
Then we don't need Louis to die for the magistrate to suddenly take on... You know, the Horla.
Yeah, if the Horla can choose for himself.
So I guess I just didn't really like that the Horla died in the fire. Like, I felt like, you know, I prefer to think of him either as a demonic influence possessing the magistrate.
Right.
Or he's a guy that's in the mind of the magistrate that's going crazy. So I guess you could say it would work that the magistrate really was crazy. This really was a diary of a madman.
Right.
And the magistrate had this idea that, hey, I'm going to burn my place down and lock the Horla in this room with me.
Right.
So I'm going to kill him by just lighting him on fire. So, like, if it's all in his mind...
He's killing himself. Yeah. So effectually, it's killing the Horla.
So he sees him die, and now
but
I can't
his plan
escape.
Was not to kill himself. He had a key that he dropped and couldn't get, and, like, the flames were engulfing things, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so Vincent Price was going to... Trap the Horla, burn up the Horla, but release himself, and his plan went sideways on him.
Right, right.
So that still goes back to the whole, they kind of left you hanging, like, do we know? Was the Horla engulfed in flames and killed, or was this all in Vincent Price's mind?
Right, right. So I guess, I guess if he really was just, you know, it really just is in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because he sees him burn up.
Yeah.
And you kind of see it visually. Or does it just violate the rules of this whole idea of him being a spirit, like a demon or something? Like this.
And we can kill it with fire.
We could kill it with fire. You know, like, I just kind of felt like, you know, we've complained. We're both Star Wars fans.
Right.
You know, we hate it when the Force can, you can do new things with a Force that you couldn't do for the last 30, 40 years, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You can invent new ways to use a Force that we've never known. So, like, we're looking at you, Princess Leia, that you can be frozen in outer space and somehow... Like, you know, use the Force to float yourself, keep yourself alive to get to the spaceship.
Right, right.
So, I don't know. I just felt like it was kind of a, like, it was kind of a turnoff or, like, lazy screenwriting or something. Like, all right, we're going to burn up the Horla. So, that was just, maybe it's just me personally. It sounded like you weren't as quite of taken aback by it.
You know, things are so iffy. I think they want to leave us with questions. So, I'm like, okay, they were trying to leave us with questions here too. Maybe. I don't know. And I have a little different perspective because I've read/listened to the short story that they tried to base this on. which really does a much better job, which we'll get into in a minute, does a much better job of leaving those questions hanging.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Even better.
Yeah, much better job. So I would say my biggest setback would be the lack of story development and character development with the other characters. Because they want us to believe there's this love triangle between, you know, the artist and then his wife, who definitely is a gold digger and wants to leave him for Vincent Price. And then there's the friend slash patron of the artist, Jean Darville. We know so little about them. And we spend so much time in the movie, like, hearing the Horla's voice. Here I am doing air quotes again that no one can see. So they spend so much time with the Horla, which we're not even really sure if it's real or not, talking out loud to Vincent Price's character when we could have been building up, you know, the characters that we end up caring nothing about because we just saw so little of them.
Absolutely.
Which is the artist, his patron, you know, and really Odette. Like, we do see a lot of Odette, but we don't have much. We mostly have Odette interacting with the magistrate and not much, very little with her husband and zero with Jean Darville, which clearly she would know Jean because that's her husband's patron.
Yeah. There's like one scene, and I can't remember what Odette says, but it's kind of a dig.
It was a little snipey.
I agree. I felt like, you know, it was a little tedious, some of those conversations between Vincent Price and the Horla.
Right.
The Horla laughing at him got kind of annoying after a while. Kind of this. Again, you know, when the husband gets arrested, you know, like, you don't feel...
Because they think he's responsible for the murder of Odette.
You don't feel 100% invested in this guy.
I know. We just had so little from him that it's like, well, we know it's not you, and that stinks to be falsely accused, but meh.
Yeah.
You know, meh.
Yeah, yeah. You spend so much more time with Vincent Price. And like, if you're going to have a love triangle, you need to spend a little bit of time with some of these other characters.
Right.
And I agree, Jean, you hardly spend any time with her other than her just obviously being in love with Paul, the husband. Right?
Yeah, exactly. But we, you know, we just get that in little tiny bits and pieces. It's never really rounded out.
So let's talk about some of the other cast. Okay, so, you know, is there anything you want to say about Paul or Jean? Like,
Not much. I mean, I saw so little of them. I don't have much to say about them.
Yeah. Then there was like the servants, right? The people, the staff that helped him out.
Yes, there were two. They were seemingly faithful, you know, household help to Vincent Price servants, which is interesting because that comes up in the short story also.
Okay.
Very different take on the servants' roles in the short story, The Horla.
Why don't we get this? Now is a good time to talk about that.
Okay,
a little bit.
Let's talk about the short story.
So I didn't obviously read the short story, but. You know, talk to us a little bit about how the short story varied from the actual film.
Sure. Well, okay, so like I said, the short story does a much better job of leaving things open-ended for you to kind of be like, wait, was he crazy? Or was there really a person there? It sticks to the diary format. So from the beginning, it's like dates like May 15th, June 12th, you know. So it never breaks character with the diary format. You're only hearing things from, and he's not a magistrate. He seems to be a wealthy-ish landowner. I'm not even sure if we ever mention his name in the whole story. I'll have to go back and look at that.
Okay.
But he's a Frenchman that clearly lives on some family land that's been around for a while. Because the first like two entries of the diary are him reminiscing about like, it's so good to live on land that you're connected to, you have roots with. I can see the Seine River right across from my front door. Mm-hmm. And I know these ships that come in and leave again. And there's such a history, you know, he's just reveling in this kind of beautiful life that he's lived with this rich, you know, family history in the place. You know, he's very grounded where he is. And then like the next, like the third or fourth entry in his diary, he starts having what sounds like maybe he suffered from the flu and he's been a little bit depressed about it. Like he's having dark moods, we'll say, right? Mm-hmm. And he hasn't felt well. And he really attributes it originally to like he's been sick. Like maybe he's had the flu or something. He's not calling it the flu. This was written in like 1886.
Uh-huh.
So it's just like he's been ill and he's struggling to get past it. So he kind of does that back and forth in a lot of the diary entries where he just has these dark places, you know, mentally, yeah, physically, that he goes to, and then he'll travel. He'll go see something different, and he'll feel a little better for a time, and he'll come back home, and then he'll find out one of his servants has also been struggling with kind of these, just not sleeping at night, feeling dark and depressed.
Really?
One of his travels, he's like walking through a forest, and he's convinced like something's in the forest with him, something's prowling, or, you know, and he... There's this episode. It's all first person. He's spinning on his heels looking for whatever's going to come out of the forest at him.
Yeah.
And nothing happens. And he goes back home and maybe he has a couple of good days. He goes to visit what I think is maybe a monastery at like Saint-Michel,
uh-huh,
in France. And I found this like comical almost, because he goes to visit, it's, you know, these religious monks or something that are in this tiny isolated place, and it's beautiful, and he's telling us, you know, telling the diary all about how like the sun is setting and the clouds and the mountain and the monastery, and he meets a priest or a monk or somebody on the beach, and he's walking, and he's telling the guy like, this must be like magical to live here, like this is so, you get to be away from the world and the cares of the world, uh-huh, and the monk's like, yeah, it's really windy here. Like, he's so like blunt and just like, well, actually, it's really a windy place, yeah, to live.
Well, those are like gems that you hear in a story.
Right?
That you just don't get in a movie, right?
No, it just cracked me up because I'm like, here, you know, this guy's waxing poetic about like, you live in such a beautiful place and you get to remove yourself from the cares of the world. And the monk's like, meh, it's really windy.
Yeah.
So I just, that kind of cracked me up. But then the monk goes on to share some of the local kind of myths that people believe, kind of the folklore, yeah, about the place, where they hear goats' voices at night. There's a he-goat and a she-goat that walk the beach at night, and they make their loud noises, and kind of just some weird happenings that people believe in the area.
Yeah.
And so the Frenchman, you know, that's writing the diary says to the monk, well, do you believe that? And he's like, well, how can I not believe it? He's like, can you see the wind? But no, but you see it doing all these things. It's blowing your hat. It's, you know, blowing the clouds, yeah, away. It's eroding mountains, yeah, you know,
philosophical,
whatever.
Philosophical monk.
Yeah, yeah. So now he all of a sudden he's like philosophical, where a minute ago he was like, eh, it's a windy place to live, you know.
Now, is there no debt?
There's no debt.
Is there a
Paul?
Is there a love triangle?
No, there's no love triangle. There's nothing. It's just this guy living his life and trying to figure out why he's being mentally tormented. And he finally, like at first you really feel like it's an ailment, right? Uh-huh. Like some sort of physical ailment. And then he starts realizing like, no, I think there's another person like living with me. Somebody's messing with me.
Yeah.
And not like a physical person. He starts to believe like it's like a spirit or something. And right, the way he realizes this is he gets up one night, he knows when he goes to bed that night that his water glass beside the bed is full to the stopper.
Uh-huh.
Like it's like some sort of glass decanter or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gets up in the middle, he starts having these nightmares at night. They're like night terrors where he feels like something's like sucking his breath out. He can't breathe. He wakes up kind of in a cold sweat.
Yeah.
And he wants to get a drink of water, and his water bottle's empty. And he knows he saw it full when he went to bed that night.
Right.
So he starts, like, obsessing about, yeah, this. It happens more and more. He wakes up in, like, these terrors at night. The water was full. He's making sure it's full when he goes to bed. And now something's drinking it in the night.
Yeah.
And at first he thinks, well, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm drinking it. I'm the one doing this. I'm the Horla, right? Like,
right.
Because he kind of has in his head. He knows there's, like, this mythos out there about a Horla.
Yeah.
But now I say, no, no, it's me. It's me. I'm sleepwalking and I don't know I'm sleepwalking, he even says. So he starts doing kind of his own little investigation,
yeah,
really.
Little experiment.
So, yeah, a little experiment. So he's putting like water and milk and wine and I think bread, strawberries, all sorts of things on the nightstand. And he's like, I'm going to see who's messing with my stuff,
yeah,
when I wake up in the middle of the night. So he starts waking up in the middle of the night. Nothing's touched except for the water and the milk. So eventually he does this a few times and he stops leaving the food and the extras out. And he's just leaving water or milk out or just water.
Yeah.
And the water's always disappearing. You
right.
Know? So now by this time he's convinced himself like there's something
that wants to drink my water.
Yes, drinking my water. Living with me.
He's got to stay hydrated, right? Whatever this thing is.
Apparently, invisible creatures need hydration very badly.
And you mentioned he toyed with the idea of like poisoning the water.
Right, exactly. So now he's like, I got to get rid of this thing. It's like making me crazy. So he tries this little setup where he like, he knows when, we'll call it the spirit, the Horla, is in the room with him. So he set up this, like, he's going to sit at a desk and pretend like he's not paying attention, but he can see from a mirror at his desk into the mirror on the armoire behind him. He's going to trap this Horla. He's going to get it. Yeah. Well, he tries that, and then he realizes, like, he's invisible. Like, I don't have any way to grab a hold of him, so that's not going to work. So he's like, well, what else can I do? He's got a few other tricks up his sleeve that just don't work because this is an invisible creature. So in his mind, he's like, fire is the only thing that's going to be able to kill this thing. Oh yeah. And you mentioned poison. He's going to poison him. He's like, well, I'll put poison in the water because he's always drinking my water. Right. Then he's like, but he's invisible. Like his body probably can't be killed by the same way my body can be killed. So poison's not going to work, and I may drink the water and poison myself. So that's a bad idea. So he throws that idea out the window. So then he comes on fire. Fire's got to be the way to do it, right? So basically, he concocts this whole plan where he's going to trick the Horla to come into his house, and he's going to lock him in and sneak out, lock the doors behind him, and set the place, douse the place in gasoline or something. 1886. Did they have gasoline? It was kerosene or something.
Right.
He's going to douse it, light it on fire. So you get to that point in the story where he has doused the place. He thinks he's trapped the Horla in his bedroom. He's gotten out into the garden and is watching his house go up in flames. And windows are starting to shatter. And he thinks he hears the screams of what he assumes is the Horla, like dying. Uh-huh. Certainly he's dead. He's dead. And then he hears real screaming and he realizes he's actually locked his servants and that he forgot that his servants were in the house.
That's terrible.
So that was like, it was treacherous, but it was an interesting departure because the movie, that did not happen. Remember, Vincent Price sent his servants away.
To like Switzerland or somewhere.
Yeah, to his other house before he even murders Odette, right?
Yeah.
Like he gets so they're out of harm's way.
The magistrate, or I guess he's not a magistrate in the short story. But
no, he's not.
He doesn't die in the fire in the movie.
No, he does not die himself. He thinks he's trapped the Horla and he's burning the Horla up and inadvertently also burns up his servants, which of course then makes him a murderer now, just like Vincent Price was in the movie. And it really ends with him in complete anguish. And he was convinced that the Horla was murdered in the fire, but then he reverses that decision right at the end of the story. And he's like, no, he's not dead. He's in me. Like in your life, it's a cliffhanger. It totally ends on a cliffhanger.
Wow.
And you're like, what? What?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought the short story really surpassed the movie for me because it was just so much more dramatic, sticking to that diary format. And you're never really sure. Like you're really in the mind of, we'll call him the magistrate, even though he's not technically a magistrate in the story.
Uh-huh.
You're really in his mind and you're just as confused as he is.
Right.
Which is kind of great.
Yeah.
It's good storytelling.
Well, you know, you just mentioned it. The short story you felt like surpassed the movie. Let's go ahead and talk through yay or nay. You know, is this a film people should see? You know, what say you, Kim?
Okay, so I'm going to give my caveats here.
Okay.
I say if you're going to read The Horla by Guy de Maupassant, which I'm probably butchering his name, then yeah, see it. Because I think that makes a fascinating comparison of the directions they took with the movie making versus the directions that the 1886 story took, right? Uh-huh. And you can come to your own conclusions of which you liked better, which you felt was more effective. If you're just going to watch the Vincent Price movie for kicks, I mean, you can, but I don't think it's something that you have to see.
Right.
So for me, it's a qualified yay.
Yeah. It's kind of like a why not go see it. Like, it's not bad, but it's not great.
Yeah, it's not horrible. It's clean. And it does, I mean, it does leave you questioning some things, which is always a great conversation starter. So there you go. But particularly if you're going to read the story and make the comparison or listen to the story.
Yeah.
I think that's a better route.
Right. And that's your perspective for sure.
Exactly. You know? I'm a literature fan, so.
Yeah. I mean, I look at what's released today. Like, we looked at Netflix earlier today. Everything's TVMA, right?
Like, literally everything.
There's so much that you could watch out there that's just really, you know, damaging and garbage, right? Like, just not good, right, for your brain to take
in. Exactly.
This is a movie that I feel like, you know, asks questions.
Yes.
And so I would say yay, you know, in comparison to other things you can watch. We've said this about several films that we've watched. You know, it's not an elite film.
No, it's not going to change your life.
It's, you know, and over time, in 20 years, this movie will probably blend with other Vincent Price movies. I'll be like, did that happen in Twice Told Tales?
Yeah, exactly.
Was it in House on Haunted Hill? You know, was it Diary of a Madman? I don't think it's a classic by any means.
Right.
But I say, why not? You know, just watch it. I think it's fun. It's definitely, you know, a great Halloween film, I think.
Very true. Very true.
So for me, it's a yay. I say go for it. You know, watch it.
Why not?
So again, remember, we are on Facebook and Instagram at Attack of the 20th Century. That's 20th. So we do have a few comments about Diary of a Madman.
Okay.
Mike Freeman 77, he said, that could be the title of any Vincent Price movie. And I think that's pretty funny because, yeah, I mean, Diary of a Madman, that's kind of like, right. Vincent Price.
Right? Exactly.
Helena Housewife says, I absolutely love this one. I remembered catching it on Turner Classic Movies late one night when I was in high school and then forgetting the name of it for years. Definitely a classic.
Okay.
And then Wretched Realm said, great classic, fire. That's an emoji. I don't know. Okay. How do you say emojis, you know, when you're
fire
talking?
Emoji. I don't know.
All right. So what are we watching next week?
Okay, next week, we are jumping forward into the 90s. We're going to watch Tales from the Dark Side, the movie. This is a rated R movie. It's a horror anthology. So it's like three creepy stories. I think one involves a mummy. I don't even know what the other ones involve.
A black cat.
Oh, yes, a black cat and something else. I don't know. I've never seen it. So this will be a first for me. I was told that it is rated R for language and violence.
Yes. So, yes. It's on HBO Max.
Excellent.
So, yep. Tales from the Dark Side. Watch it. We'll come back and we'll review it next week.
Yes.
So in the meantime, have a great week.
Yep. Enjoy your movies, guys.
All right. Peace out.
Peace out.